Without question, Stanton was rude, snobbish, and supercilious toward the unknown Lincoln, but so was everyone else connected with the case. Harding, for example, never opened the lengthy manuscript which Lincoln had prepared as his contribution. When one of the presiding jurists entertained the counsel on both sides, Lincoln was not invited. Although all the lawyers were staying at the same hotel, none asked Lincoln to share their table, to visit them in their rooms, or to join them on the daily walks to and from the court.
So writes a biographer of Edwin Stanton, one of those snobbish attorneys in that case of 1855. Although Abraham Lincoln said not a single word in the landmark McCormick-Reaper patent case, it may well have been the event that changed him from a prairie lawyer into a first-rate attorney and a political force for the ages. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How successful was Lincoln the lawyer? Without the benefit of formal schooling, how did he make the jump from backwoods circuit rider to the U.S. House of Representatives? And when he was voted out of office after a single term, how did he use his experience as a lawyer to win the presidency of the United States? Well, we'll also have a look at Lincoln's relationship with the state of Wisconsin before this conversation is up. And our guest is John Skilton, a trial lawyer and lecturer on Abraham Lincoln, a lawyer for the ages. He was also the chair of the recent Wisconsin Lincoln Bicentennial Commission.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
It's nice to be here.
You write in one of your articles that more has been written about Lincoln than just about any other figure other than Jesus. Why do you think that is?
Well, to some extent, he's still relevant today. And the other thing that is phenomenal about him is that it's a true living incarnation of the American dream from the prairie to the White House. And so everybody seems fascinated, myself included, with the question of, so how did he get there? What was the progress of a person who never went to a high school, much less university or law school? What was his progress to being able to be not only the president of the United States during its worst and most challenging period, but also someone who could articulate some of the great speeches in the history of this country, including the second inaugural address and the Gettysburg Address?
What did it take to become a lawyer in Illinois in the 1830s?
Well, it took a lot of time and persistence. And, of course, when you ask me the question, you've got me in the 1830s. There you had to simply be able to work whatever came in the door. Lincoln, interestingly, wasn't just a trial lawyer. He was an office lawyer as well. And his career has been studied on a day-to-day basis from roughly 1836 until he went to the White House in 1860. And so there's a natural progression that you see as that Illinois lawyer was working for more than just chicken feed. Which is what he started out working for, to representing the railroads in major cases in the 1850s.
What was the status of lawyers like? I know you're a lawyer, so I'll be careful here, but there are a lot of anti-lawyer sentiments, a lot of, you know, lawyer jokes. When Lincoln chose to become a lawyer back in the 1830s, what was the perception of lawyers?
Well, Lincoln actually interestingly commented on that in his notes on the practice of law, which is roughly dated in 1850. And his remarks at the time indicated that he was well aware of the reputational problems that lawyers even had in those days. And with your indulgence, let me give you Lincoln's answer as of 1850. There is a vague popular belief that lawyers are necessarily dishonest. I say vague because when we consider to what extent confidence and honors are reposed in and conferred upon lawyers by the people, it appears improbable that their impression of dishonesty is very distinct and vivid. Yet the impression is common, almost universal. Let no young man choosing the law for a calling for a moment yield to this popular belief. Resolve to be honest in all events, and if in your own judgment you cannot be an honest lawyer, resolve to be honest without being a lawyer. Choose some other occupation, rather the one in the choosing of which you do consent to be a knave. And Lincoln had a way of putting everything, and even in 1850 he put it pretty well. And I think that sentiment expressed to young lawyers at the time applies with full force today.
What kind of apprenticeship did Lincoln have?
Lincoln's apprenticeship was, to some extent, self-taught, but it is also clear that he was mentored into the practice. He served originally, came to Wisconsin in part, as part of the Black Hawk War, and John Stewart was his commanding officer. John Stewart was a lawyer in Springfield, and within months of Lincoln becoming a lawyer, he became an apprentice, mentored by John Stewart. There began his training in a real sense in the law by experienced lawyers who knew what they were doing and showed him how to do it. And so it progressed to Stephen Logan, to the point where then Lincoln, had, in his early 40s, was able himself to take on a partner, Billy Herndon, who he was a partner with from roughly 1846 until 1861.
I suppose it's hard to tell much about Lincoln from the kind of cases he chose because, you know, a lawyer will take on the side of someone that he personally doesn't agree with. So just because Lincoln was, you know, taking a case doesn't mean he supported that. But do we know of any instances over those many years that he was a lawyer when he turned down a case?
Well, undoubtedly there were such instances. What has been tracked, of course, are the cases he's taken. And in that study of what he took, you're right, there's a diversity of kinds of cases, criminal, civil, from the smallest petty crime to major railroad disputes to the one involving the bridge in the Heard case, which was a major event in the history of railroads in this country. But clearly there were some cases that he took that he didn't quite believe in. And that's been the subject of some ethical writings on whether Lincoln, in all occasions, was fully enthusiastic about the position he was taking. That said, the most interesting case on the study of Lincoln and his ability to represent issues that he didn't quite believe in is the study of the slave case, wherein he took the position of the Kentucky slave owner in the return of slaves to Kentucky from the free state of Illinois in 1847. And there he was essentially the surrogate of the Fugitive Slave Act and represented unsuccessfully, I might add, the slave owner in that owner's attempt to have the slaves returned to Kentucky. A lot has been written about the strange irony of Lincoln taking that position.
Well, the fact that he lost it makes you wonder how hard he tried.
Well, that's the question that historians have raised, but lawyers react violently to that as a concept.
A bad precedent.
And in fact, they've studied the arguments that were made by Lincoln, which were fully reported in the press. It was a very notorious case in Illinois at the time. And in fact, Lincoln was labeled by one of the bards of the time as the slave hound of Illinois for his efforts. But the analysis that lawyers make is that the argument he made at the time in support of the returning of the slaves was forcefully made and was the best argument available to him, and he lost. And it was essentially that these were transient, not permanent residents who were there simply temporarily to work the farm and then to be returned to Kentucky. He lost that argument.
How many cases in the course of his legal career, which I suppose we're talking about roughly 25 years?
24 years. Yeah.
How many cases would he and his partners have handled?
Well, the Lincoln Legal Papers study in out of Springfield has estimated that there are over 5,000
wow.
cases associated with Lincoln and his partners that have been traceable. Some other statistics are really mind-boggling, that he had handled over 400 cases in the Illinois Supreme Court case, many of which he argued in the Supreme Court of Illinois, many of which he argued himself, which gives you some sense of the scope of his practice as well as the significance of it. He was not a country lawyer when he gave the famous speech in Cooper Union in New York. He was a seasoned, well-known and respected powerhouse Illinois lawyer at that time, something that wasn't acknowledged in the media publicity given to him. He was viewed as, I'm going to say, a small-town lawyer.
You've pointed out three cases that really are landmarks in terms of Lincoln's development, not just as a lawyer, but we'll say as a statesman. What's the first one?
Well, I actually have borrowed from historians here, and interestingly, they more or less got it right. Ida Tarbell, Doris Kearns Goodwin of her day, identified five. Of those, I selected three. What they have in common is the period of time that I focus on, and that is after his return from Congress, roughly from 1852 to 1857. And in identifying those cases, I was able to identify his progress from a country lawyer doing country lawyer things to a full-fledged commercial litigator doing big cases. And starting with his representation of the railroads, I traced the first major railroad case that involved the McLean County tax case, which involved the question of whether the county could tax the railroad going through or whether it was by charter of the state, a case that was subject strictly to the sovereignty of the state of Illinois in terms of taxation. And you can understand, not only in Illinois, but nationally, how that issue would be a very important issue, railroad development throughout the country.
To be taxed by every county along your route could be a little pricey even for railroads.
And he established a very important precedent that only the state could tax the railroad in that instance. That's a case that more or less got him started with a very important feature of his practice, which was the representation of railroads. That was important for several reasons. Most primarily is that he was able to make, if you will, the big bucks in that kind of representation. In fact, the postscript to the McLean case is the $5,000 fee that he got out of it. And remember, we're talking now mid-1850s. That's an enormous fee that he got out of it. In fact, he had to sue to get it. Now, how hard the Illinois Central fought him on that is a question of some speculation. But in any event, he did get that fee, and half of which he gave to Herndon, the other half of which financed his run for the presidency.
It's hard to imagine this is $2,500 to finance your presidential bid.
But I suppose it shows that, I mean, if he could represent the railroad company and win on its behalf, but then also turn around and sue them when they were planning to pay him, what, only the $2,500?
Right.
And I mean, that he had the kind of independence, I suppose, from them that he could turn around and sue them.
He did. And, of course, at the time there was no firm ethical code, so some of these questions are head-scratchers for lawyers today. But the truth is that the Illinois Central permitted it. And, in fact, he did appear on both sides on occasion, though normally his representation was with the railroad.
So he got more railroad cases as a result of this, despite the little bit of friction involved toward the end there.
Yes, he did, and was very much the railroad's lawyer, along with others. But he was the prominent litigator in Illinois in the 1850s for the interests of the railroads.
I guess I find it amazing to think of him doing these cases without ever having gone to high school, college, or law school. You know, he must have just done an awful lot of reading on his own.
Law is a matter of reading, and he did read. He read cases, and he read them carefully, and he did a lot of appellate work, which is something like being in law school, because after all, law students are often taught out of the appellate reports. But I also thematically believe that Lincoln was taught by the mentors that he was privileged to serve under, carrying their bags, so to speak, for the first 6 to 8 years of his practice. And I here mention Logan and Stuart in that regard. Logan was viewed to be the lawyer of his time, the best lawyer in Illinois. And Lincoln worked for Logan for a good 4 years and was apparently greatly influenced by what he learned from Logan. So the combination of case reading and being mentored by experienced lawyers is pretty close to law school.
Sure. And do we know how he was in the courtroom as a speaker? And, you know, kind of, I would assume that he was quite eloquent and persuasive.
Well, Herndon, his last partner, has mixed views of Lincoln in the courtroom. And by that, I mean he thinks that when Lincoln took the time to prepare, that he was a wonderful courtroom lawyer. At the time, the civil cases were viewed as nisi prius cases. And Herndon's view was when he was well prepared, there was no better lawyer in Illinois. But when he was attempting to do it off the cuff or spontaneously, he was relatively mediocre. And how he appeared as a lawyer is a matter of report by Herndon. If you're interested, mm-hmm. I'll read it to you because it's the most poignant description, I believe, of Lincoln in a courtroom. Mr. Lincoln was 6 feet and 4 inches high in his sock feet. He was consumptive by build and hence more or less stoop-shouldered. He was very tall, thin, and gaunt. When he rose to speak to the jury or to crowds of people, he stood inclined forward, was awkward, angular, ungainly, odd, and being a very sensitive man, I think that it added to his awkwardness. He was a diffident man, somewhat, and a sensitive one, and both of these added to his oddity, awkwardness, etc., as it seemed to me. Lincoln's voice was, when he first began speaking, shrill, squeaking, piping, unpleasant. His general look, his form, his pose, the color of his flesh, wrinkled and dry, his sensitiveness and his momentary diffidence, everything seemed to be against him, but he soon recovered. I can see him now in my mind distinct. On rising to address the jury or the crowd, he quite generally placed his hands behind him, the back part of his left hand resting on the palm of his right hand. As he proceeded and grew warmer, he moved his hands to the front of his person, generally interlocking his fingers and running one thumb around the other. Sometimes his hands, for a short while, would hang by his side. In still growing warmer as he proceeded in his address, he used his hands, especially and generally his right hands, in his gestures. He used his head a great deal in speaking, throwing or jerking or moving it now here and now there, now in this position and now in that, in order to be more emphatic, to drive the idea home. Mr. Lincoln never beat the air, never sawed space with his hands, never acted for stage effect, was cool, careful, earnest, sincere, truthful, fair, self-possessed, not insulting, not dictatorial, was pleasing, good-natured, and had great strong naturalness of look, pose, and act. He used in his gestures his right hand, sometimes shooting out that long, bony forefinger of his to dot an idea or to express a thought, resting his thumb on his middle finger. Bear in mind that he did not gesticulate much, and yet it is true that every organ of his body was in motion and acted with ease, elegance, and grace. So it all seemed to me.
It's certainly vivid. And we do tend to forget that this was a time of bombast in oratory, to the time of the two-hour speech, not the sound bite, and that this would, I assume, be somewhat the case in the courtroom, too, whereas Lincoln was counter to the type, is what Herndon seems to be telling us.
To some extent, and yet he learned as well as he went through his experience of maturing in the law. One of the very interesting comments is how he argued the Hurd case, the railroad bridge case, and by one of the authors who described his argument as succinct and terse and absent some of the gauchism of earlier arguments of a untrained lawyer. All of a sudden, this man was arguing in sophisticated terms to sophisticated juries in a very important case involving the fight between the river traffic and the railroad bridge in a very pivotal time in the state of railroad development. Here it was, the bridge going across the Mississippi River in Illinois.
And we'll look at the two more formative cases for the development of Abraham Lincoln when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
¶¶
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest John Skilton. And on this February 12th, we're looking at the rise of Abraham Lincoln from a prairie lawyer to a statesman of national, in fact, international repute, a man for the ages. Lincoln has the distinction of being the only U.S. president to have taken out a patent. And so it's, I suppose, not at all, entirely inappropriate that he would come through a crucible of development in the McCormick Reaper case, which was so heavily involving patent fine points.
And Lincoln is, just to follow that point, is very much associated with the progression of patent law in this country. If you go to the Department of Commerce in Washington, you'll see one of Lincoln's inscriptions relating to the need that patents serve in terms of protecting the economic development of this country. In fact, the United States Patent Office was, I believe, established when Lincoln was president. So Lincoln was a great promoter of patents. The one patent that I think you're referring to was some kind of inflatable a barge
that
went up and down with the currents,
yes.
Likely the result of the Heard case and the work he did there. I haven't mentioned the Heard case. I will later in the broadcast, but there is a case where he was putting on expert witnesses that talked about tides and the mechanics, et cetera, all of the kinds of sophisticated things that happen today in sophisticated commercial litigation.
And what about the Reaper, then, that was invented by Cyrus McCormick in 1834? How did Lincoln get involved in a case that involved that?
Very interestingly, he got involved because originally they thought the case was going to be tried in federal court in Illinois, and the commission of the young person who was told to get a lawyer who could do it was to find the best trial lawyer in Illinois to do it, and they came upon Abraham Lincoln through reputation, and they contacted him, and Lincoln's expectation was that he was going to be the prime trial lawyer in the McCormick Reaper case that was to be tried in Illinois, but then thereafter venue was transferred to Ohio, so Lincoln's role became secondary, though he didn't know it until he arrived
in Cincinnati,
and that's how we started this broadcast with how he was greeted by the trial team then present, including Edwin M. Stanton, a very prominent lawyer nationally at the time from the Pittsburgh area, who had been employed to try that patent case in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cincinnati at that point, well, I think even then was calling itself the Queen City of the West, and yet obviously strong confluence of East and West when it came to attorneys here. And it's one thing to be an attorney out on the prairie, out, you know, what was then the western part of the country, something else entirely to be New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Pittsburgh attorney.
That's right. And again, the commission was to find the very best patent lawyer and patent litigator combination, which is not unusual today. You combine the local and the national when you're doing sophisticated patent litigation. And the combination originally struck was Lincoln as the trial lawyer coming out of Illinois, the home district. That didn't work, of course, when the case got shifted to Cincinnati, and Lincoln found himself then arriving in Cincinnati thinking he was going to do more than, in fact, it turned out that he did, which, in fact, was nothing in the case.
I like the description that you include in your article of it's Harding describing Lincoln as looking like a tall, rawly-boned, ungainly backwoodsman with coarse, ill-fitting clothing, his trousers hardly reaching his ankles, holding in his hands a blue cotton umbrella with a ball on the end of the handle.
The umbrella made a particular impression for some reason.
But this I guess he must have come across as sort of a country hick.
Clearly he did, and so he was regarded by Stanton and others who were the primary trial lawyers in the case. He was shunned, is the word. When parties would occur, as they did on occasion, he was not invited. When the judge invited the lawyers, both sides, to come to dinner, Lincoln was not invited, not even a courtesy extended. The trial was held in the courtroom. He sat in the back, sometimes paced, but did nothing, said nothing. But what he did do in this case, and the reason that I include it in such a profound way, is that he learned from the case. And how he learned and what he learned is anecdotally, just by seeing a case like that tried and by such lawyers as Stan, but also from his own comments to one of the young men who was charged with administering it on behalf of the client who was present and got to know Lincoln on a personal basis. And he comments on what Lincoln said to him as Lincoln was leaving Cincinnati at the conclusion of the trial. And if you'd like me to read some of that, I'll read to you how he quotes Abraham Lincoln. His name was Emerson. Quoting Lincoln, "I'm going home to study law. I am going home to study law," he exclaimed repeatedly, as he and Emerson walked from the courtroom down to the river when the hearing had ended. Emerson said that that was what he had been doing. "No," Lincoln replied, "not as these college-bred men study it. I have learned my lesson. These college-bred fellows have reached Ohio. They will soon be in Illinois. And when they come, Emerson, I will be ready for them." From that time on, insists Emerson, who often heard Lincoln thereafter, his style and manner of speech and argument improved greatly and steadily. The result, as the old manufacturer stoutly contended throughout his long life, of Lincoln's connection with a celebrated patent case of McCormick versus Manny et al.
This was just a, it was a patent infringement suit is what it was, that somebody had, in effect, stolen or borrowed or co-opted McCormick's plan for this Reaper, which it was already being so successful. And so Lincoln had to obviously know something about how all of the finer points of the machine work. And you mentioned, John, that he wrote a long, detailed summary or brief of the case, which was never used.
Never read.
Do we still have that, though?
No.
We don't even know.
It hasn't been located. My belief is it was discarded with other so-called not valuable papers at some time before the significance of Lincoln's legal career was probed.
You also mentioned that Stanton perhaps referred to him as a giraffe.
Yes, by a number of unflattering names. It's somewhat apocryphal, but it was current at the time that descriptions like that were made by Stanton of Lincoln at the time. And one of the most poignant postscripts to this entire story is told well by Doris Kearns Goodwin in her book, Team of Rivals, where, of course, Lincoln found Stanton again to be Secretary of War. And I quote, and I'll see if I can locate Stanton's reaction, of course, when Lincoln died and Stanton was at his bedside. It's going to take me some time.
Stanton was actually undercutting Lincoln quite a bit, even from his cabinet position, wasn't he, during the war?
Well, that's a matter of some dispute. His biographer felt that Stanton's biographer felt that Stanton was very much a supporter of Lincoln and a protector of Lincoln. Indeed, when Lincoln died, Stanton actually was going to be fired by that President Johnson, Andrew Johnson. And Stanton would have none of it, primarily because he wanted to try to follow Lincoln's policies as he understood them with respect to, for example, Reconstruction.
Right.
And he basically had a sit-in in the office of the Secretary of War. They couldn't remove him and didn't remove him until some months later. But it was out of respect for Abraham Lincoln. The recent movie The Conspiracy features that somewhat indirectly in its recount of the aftermath of the assassination conspiracy. Stanton sat in.
But certainly it's moving that Stanton, who had been so snooty and so insulting, would change his tune about Lincoln after seeing him as president.
Well, it shows you, I think, what is a truth about Lincoln, and that is that his first impression often was that of a hick, of someone who would have anecdotes and stories and be casual in his speech, but not to those who got to know him. And Stanton is maybe the best example of that kind of study of Lincoln, the person. And to watch the depth of his ability to analyze, to speak, to solve problems, etc., one-on-one and intimately, was to see a side of Lincoln that was, I think, somewhat difficult to see. You had to know him.
It would be interesting to know, if we don't, what Stanton's thinking was when we're talking only, what, maybe 5 or 6 years after this McCormick-Reaper case, when Lincoln extends the invitation to Stanton to become his Secretary of War.
Well, I think his initial thoughts, and here I rely on Doris Kearns Goodwin to some extent in my recall, but his initial thoughts were snooty toward Lincoln. But captured also by Doris Kearns Goodwin were his last thoughts on Lincoln. And I'll quote from her book. "Until the moment of Lincoln's death, Stanton's coolness and self-possession had seemed remarkable to those around him. Now he could not stop the tears that streamed down his cheeks. In the days that followed, even as he worked tirelessly to secure the city and catch the conspirators, Stanton's grief was uncontrollable," recalled Horace Porter. "And at the mention of Mr. Lincoln's name, he would break down and weep bitterly. While Stanton's raw grief surprised those who had seen only his gruff exterior, John Hay understood. 'Not everyone knows as I do,' he wrote Stanton, 'how close you stood to our lost leader, how he loved you and trusted you, and how vain were all the efforts to shake that trust and confidence, not lightly given and never withdrawn. All this will be known sometime, of course, to his honor and yours.'" That is the same Stanton who shunned Lincoln on first impressions in Cincinnati.
You have mentioned several times the famous bridge case with the railroads and Lincoln, and we're going to look at that and also Lincoln's presence in Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I am not an accomplished lawyer. I find quite as much material for a lecture in those points wherein I have failed as in those wherein I have been moderately successful. Those are the words of Abraham Lincoln in 1850 in his Notes on Practice of Law. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Skilton, and we're looking at the Lincoln who was a lawyer before he became president. We've talked about two cases that you said were seminal to his formation into the Lincoln that we know him as. The third one you've alluded to, which is something having to do with a bridge.
Right. The F.E. Afton case involved the Rock Island Bridge across the Mississippi River, and it was a case that was very notorious in its time because it had the competing commercial interests stacked one against the other, and that was the commercial interest of barge and commercial traffic down the Mississippi versus the need of the railroads to continue going west and to build bridges over those rivers, including, of course, the mighty Mississippi. The F.D. Afton case was one wherein a barge, a major barge, hit the tiers and piers of the Rock Island Bridge that was owned by the railroad company, and therein lay the basis for a suit. Who was responsible? Should the bridge be torn down? And how, in fact, did the captain, if you will, run it into the bridge? At the time, there were conspiracy theories that the barge owner, in fact, intended to do it in order to get a suit and have the bridge removed. But Lincoln stepped in to the case when it was close to being ready for trial, and his participation in that case is what I think was illustrative of the progress that he had made by then. Now we're talking the fall of 1857. As a trial lawyer, as a lawyer dealing with large and sophisticated matters, with all that entails in trying a major commercial case.
Well, and there were, large and small considerations here, or I would say large and then detailed, because I guess a lot of the question revolving around the bridge and whether it should be there or not had to do with technical testimony as to did the bridge affect the river currents in a way that would tend to draw barges into the bridge on the one hand. And on the other hand, as you say, John, this whole issue, what's the priority here? Is it river traffic or is it rail traffic?
And, of course, the newspapers at the time featured both aspects of it, with the city of St. Louis rooting for the barge traffic and the city of Chicago rooting for the railroads. And the papers read accordingly, so to speak. And it was reported almost verbatim. It's an interesting sidelight that in those times there wasn't much transcription, verbatim transcription, of lawyers' arguments or questions and answers in a trial. We take it for granted today. Now recorded used to be transcribed. But in those days, it was, for the most part, we rely on newspaper accounts. And one of the features, one of the marks of an important case is how thoroughly reported it was in the newspapers. This case was reported in both sets of newspapers and nationally almost on a word-for-word basis. They knew what Lincoln argued. They knew what the other lawyers argued. They knew what the evidence was. They reported on it as if it were a verbatim transcript. So we don't have to guess much in terms of what was being argued or how it was being argued.
And what was it that makes you think Lincoln did a good job? In other words, what do you see that's representative of his skill?
Well, again, I'm going to rely on a secondary source here, and if I may quote from one of the outstanding lawyer biographers of Abraham Lincoln, John Duff, who wrote a book some years ago. And this is how he describes Lincoln's contribution to the case, describing his argument. The argument, with its concise summarization of weeks of testimony, is worthy of consideration in some detail, for it clearly shows the acuity with which Lincoln grasped every implication of the evidence. Absent here were the gaucheries which crept into some of his jury appeals before the circuit courts. Throughout, his self-restraint is manifest. Reasoning well and slowly, Lincoln defended his client's position with resourceful logic, assembling an arsenal of temperate, cogent arguments which had prophetic savor. He sensed that if the case were won by the river interests, the extensions of railroads westward and the liberation of the Great West would be seriously delayed, and conversely, if the defendants prevailed, the cinder-strewn change would open the way to almost limitless possibilities of expansion.
Where was the court located for this trial, and what level court was it?
This was a case that was in state court, and ultimately, by the way, it was a hung jury, so there was no real conclusion to be reached. So the point of all of this is not that Lincoln won every case, but the point of the discussion of these cases, from my point of view, was to show the progress of Lincoln as a lawyer from the prairie and prairie law through the most sophisticated litigation available to any lawyer in the United States at that time.
And would he have been part of a team of attorneys?
Yes, he was. And that is, again, it wasn't unusual then. It's not unusual now. There were at least three major participants of lawyers for each side of the issue, and Lincoln was one of that team, but as Duff points out, was a very important part of that team.
And he is presenting the case before a jury?
Before a jury. And that jury hung ultimately.
And was he at this point practicing law but having the ambition to be a politician instead? In other words, was the law sort of what he was doing to pay the rent equivalent, but he really, it wasn't his dream?
Well, I'm at a loss for the phrase that Lincoln used to describe the tug of politics, but there is a phrase that is Lincolnian in that regard. But regardless, Lincoln always felt it. When he had his bad experience in Congress, he went back to Illinois, dedicated to the proposition, not to borrow from Lincoln, that he was going to be a lawyer and the best lawyer he could be from that point in time on, and that was true. But politics continued to be that siren to Lincoln, and of course we know that he was dividing time with both activities. He was no longer in the Illinois state legislature, but he became quite involved nationally. It was 2 years late, but he joined the Republican Party, and then, of course, the Lincoln-Douglas debates came in 1857 and 1858 in his run for Senate, which he lost in the Illinois legislature. So politics was a part of his interest and commitment, really, throughout the time that he was a lawyer. Sometimes, some periods, however, he spent more time as a lawyer than he did as a politician, and then in the latter period of the 1850s, he was spending an inordinate amount of time as a politician, certainly according to Mary Lincoln.
And the year after those Lincoln-Douglas debates, he was in Wisconsin.
He was in Wisconsin in 1859, and one of the things we did in the Lincoln Bicentennial celebration was to celebrate Lincoln's major, if not only real trip. He had, of course, been in Wisconsin in the Black Hawk War, but in 1859, he went to Wisconsin at the request of the Wisconsin Agricultural Society and gave a major speech on agriculture in Wisconsin at that fair at that time. And that trip has been the subject of some of the attention that the Bicentennial Commission paid. And part of the trip, of course, was to do some political work in Janesville and Beloit at the end of the trip.
Political work in terms of trying to get voters?
Yeah, he was working the Republican side. Mm-hmm. He was working the Republican side of the ledger on that that portion of the trip, and a very interesting one. But the speech that he gave in Milwaukee was one that that is significant to Wisconsinites and somewhat unknown nationally, but of significance, I think, in terms of what he said and how he said it, both in terms of the economics of agriculture as he saw it, but in terms of some of his words. They were Lincoln-esque and profound. One of the paragraphs that we had featured in the Bicentennial celebration is now on a plaque in front of the War Memorial Center in Milwaukee. And I would like to read, if I may, that paragraph, because I think it captures Lincoln as of September 30th, 1859, as well as anything could, as he existed now just before he ascended to the presidency of the United States. And this is how he ended his speech in Milwaukee. "It is said an Eastern monarch once charged his wise men to invent him a sentence to be ever in view and which should be true and appropriate in all times and situations. They presented him the words, 'And this too shall pass away.' How much it expresses, how chastening in the hour of pride, how consoling in the depths of affliction, 'And this too shall pass away.' And yet let us hope it is not quite true. Let us hope rather that by the best cultivation of the physical world beneath and around us and the intellectual and moral world within us, we shall secure an individual social and political prosperity and happiness whose course shall be onward and upward and which, while the earth endures, shall not pass away." Now, that's the eloquence of Abraham Lincoln.
That's the Gettysburg Address, a little bit of a foretaste of what he would be writing 4 years later.
And indeed, it's got that beautiful sort of biblical cadence, a lot of other. What else do you hear in the language there that makes that so much Lincoln's voice?
I hear the practical as well, and goes to reality. He was a realist. It also is a projection and a hope. His writing is the ability to combine complex thoughts, but simply and eloquently stated, an economy of language, The Gettysburg Address is the classic example. How much was said, and yet in so few words. A master he was, and one of the awesome, using a word that my grandchildren now use, awesome things about Lincoln was his ability to convert what he knew into language that was had cadence and was beautifully stated and succinctly stated.
Is that, do you think, what makes lawyers, so many lawyers become politicians, is they have to have, what, a grasp of the law, of course, and of the what it takes to debate points of law, and they also have to have this desire to work with the public and maybe to sell an idea.
I believe that's certainly a fair statement. I believe that the skills of presentation, argument, and persuasion are the skills of a lawyer. Certainly they were the skills that were honed and developed by Abraham Lincoln in his 24 years in the pit of the law. And it's those skills in particular, as well as negotiation, mediation, and frankly confrontation, the ability to understand how the dynamics of resolution occur, that was a composite of the skills that Lincoln had in diversity of his practice and convertible into the skills that he not only used as a politician, but interestingly as an administrator of this country when all of the skills were simultaneously required and deployed by Lincoln in his conduct of the war. He became the general of the war. He was the civilian administrator. He was the legal head of how one deals with a country at war. Made some surprising decisions to people who think of Lincoln as a great civil libertarian.
Well, yes, the charge of being a dictator.
You know, the language of the time is convertible into the kind of language that we hear today oftentimes. Lincoln was not universally liked. Was criticized, did some strange things in the sense of how people would have thought he would have acted. The suspension of the Great Writ of Habeas Corpus is an example. The use of military tribunals, the suppression of the press, all of those things were done by Lincoln in the course of conducting the horrible task of being the commander-in-chief of the Civil War. It was a very difficult undertaking, needless to say, and Lincoln did it with a full deployment, I believe, of every skill that he ever learned in 24 years as a practicing lawyer.
Do you know of any instances where some of these questionable decisions, moves made by Lincoln, were challenged legally and overturned?
The Supreme Court is one, and he essentially ignored the Supreme Court. It was on his use of habeas corpus. And today, of course, we still litigate Lincoln's military tribunals in modern Supreme Court precedent. He was not certainly he was not loved in the South, to say the least. And so, yes, they were controversial then and frankly, controversial now. There are remnants of Lincoln in some of the Guantanamo litigation and military tribunal litigation. So Lincoln's legacy isn't a perfect legacy. But in my mind, there's an historical perspective. We learn from history. And we don't condemn by historical setting. Our founders had their own set of problems, and their resolution was imperfect. Lincoln had his set of problems. The questions of Lincoln on race, was he a believer in full equality? When did he come to the abolition of slavery? What about his letter to Horace Greeley? All of these things are a matter of context and time. But Lincoln came to the right conclusion, maybe late, but it was a matter of his own intuitive beliefs, his biblical background, his brilliance and genius, but his knowledge of the times. And he has to be evaluated in the context of the time and the problem that he was dealing with.
Was the Emancipation Proclamation, strictly speaking, legal?
Well, it was an executive order. He made it legal by his issuance of it. Was it ahead of the Constitution? I mean, we needed the 13th Amendment. And, of course, remember, it was a war order. And accordingly, and it did not free all slaves.
Right, just
all
those slaves in those areas
in the
were
southern
in
states, basically. And so my answer is, yes, it was legal. Was it constitutional? We did get the 13th Amendment, which was Lincoln's amendment.
We actually bent the Constitution to fit the proclamation.
And the reality of the circumstance, and of course there are some cynical aspects of when it was released. We're all aware of it being in his desk for some period of time and wanting to have at least some semblance of victory and a political use of it before it was released to the public, et cetera, and that there was an element of winning the war and the freeing of the blacks in order to prosecute the war and so on and so forth. These are all complex overlays. But the truth of the matter is that what came out of it was the abolition of slavery in the form of the 13th Amendment, which may well have been his greatest legal contribution to the history of this country.
Do you think he's justified in the label Honest Abe? Can you be a lawyer and be Honest Abe?
Yes, is the answer. It's unequivocal on that. He was an honest man.
And on this Lincoln birthday, final thoughts you have on Lincoln's most important legacy?
I think it's the legacy of courage under fire. It's the legacy of the great American dream being realized, the belief, I think, in the fundamental goodness of people, the better angels of our nature, to borrow from Lincoln, that a good man was able to be in charge when we needed him most, but that was a complex good man, that he did some things that we don't agree with, that he wasn't perfect, that he had his own demons to live with, and yet he rose above it and gifted this country with a legacy of eloquence and of purpose. His wonderful resonating phrase, "the great unfinished task," he left us in death with that still to be done, and this country is still working to get it done. But it's a Lincoln task in my mind.
John Skilton has been our guest for this hour. Thank you for taking a close look at Lincoln, the lawyer, with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.